so often here on No Nonsense Nutrition, what I talk about is the things that you eat that can hurt you. Well, I think we don't spend enough time talking about the things that you don't eat that can hurt you. It's not just too much sugar and too much salt and too much saturated fat. We eat too much of all three of them. In fact, we eat too much, period. But we also eat too little. And we especially eat too little of several key players that really have a tremendous amount to do with your long-term and overall health. And if I start out with, you know, what one of the ones that I consider to be absolutely the most important, then I've got to start out by talking about potassium. You know, it's interesting to me that we can take a spotlight and shine it on one particular food, but or one particular constituent in food, but we never eat that constituent. We eat it as part of a diet. And before this show is over, we're going to talk about how to put that diet together. But think about just one extra serving of a potassium-rich food every day could reduce your risk of stroke by 40%. You know, when they analyzed diets of over 850 men and women living in Southern California, the investigators documented that small differences in potassium predicted who would die of a stroke 12 years later. Remarkably, nobody with the highest intake of potassium, which is over 3,500 milligrams a day, died of a stroke. Nobody. But those who regularly ate the least amount of potassium, less than 2,000 milligrams a day, had much higher fatal stroke rates than all the others. And those who skimped the most on potassium, the odds of stroke deaths went up more than 2.5 times in men and almost 5 times in women. More potassium-rich foods really made a huge difference in the subjects that they studied. There were just fewer strokes all the way across the board. And the researchers concluded that every 400 milligrams of potassium, the risk of fatal stroke dropped 40%. That critical margin of 400 milligrams of potassium is so modest, you'll find it in a single piece of fruit or vegetables, a glass of milk, a small chunk of fish. If you thought it would help your brain, help protect your brain from a devastating and possibly irreversible human catastrophe known as a cerebrovascular accident or a stroke, wouldn't it be worth it every day to eat an extra quarter of cantaloupe or a half an avocado or a small baked potato or a few dried apricots or a half a cup of baked beans or a little tin of sardines? High potassium foods help to lower blood pressure. But potassium exhibits a lot of additional powers to prevent stroke, separate from just blood pressure. There's a hypertension expert up at University of Minnesota, and he fed rats that had high blood pressure a high potassium diet or a normal potassium diet. 40% of the normal potassium diet got small strokes evidenced by bleeding in the brain, but no brain hemorrhages occurred in rats that were eating a high potassium diet. So Dr. Tobias' theory at University of Minnesota is that extra potassium keeps artery walls elastic and functioning normally. And thus, it immunizes the blood vessels against damage from high pressure. And remember, excess amounts of salt, and it doesn't even have to be a teaspoon a day, 1,500 milligrams, that's about two-thirds of a teaspoon, is enough to make the artery walls hard. So excess salt hardens the artery walls, and plenty of potassium keeps the artery walls elastic. And you know, when you think about 400 milligrams of potassium, it doesn't really take a lot. Half a cup of cooked fresh spinach. I don't know about you, but I love spinach. I love spinach salads, and I love cooked spinach, and I love spinach and eggs. In fact, we keep a bag of organic frozen spinach in the freezer all the time and mix it with our eggs several times during the week. You're going to get over 400 milligrams just with a half a cup of cooked fresh spinach. And I remind you, this is one we really want to get organic, because spinach ended up on the top 5 of vegetables that is often pesticide contaminated. Now, it may be true that less people are going to eat fresh beet greens or put blackstrap molasses in things, but a whole lot of people will have a cup of tomato juice. And you can get low-sodium tomato juice now in the can. That's a certainly a lot better beverage to have than one of those sugar sweetened, you know, soda pops that's out there. A cup of orange juice. So tomato juice or orange juice, you're going to get over 400 milligrams. In fact, close to 500 milligrams in a cup. Almost every melon is high in potassium, but cantaloupe wins the award because about a quarter of a cantaloupe, you're going to get over 400 milligrams. One of my favorites, acorn squash. Oh boy, I could eat it 27 ways. Just, you know, steam it, bake it, cut it up into cubes after you peel it and put it into the rice when you cook it and make squash rice. Cut it up into discs, dribble a little maple syrup on it. Half a cup of acorn squash, 450 milligrams of potassium. A couple of carrots. I'm a big carrot salad fan. I love my carrot salad, and I don't like pineapple or raisins or anything else in it. I like carrots. And I'll take one scoop of brown rice vinegar, and, well, I guess not a scoop, a spoon of brown rice vinegar and a spoon of honey and 2 spoons of mayonnaise and mix it together. Depends on how much carrots I have as to how big those spoons are. But I'll knock out a carrot salad pretty much every week. Simple enough to do, and just 2 carrots alone, 450 milligrams of potassium. Sweet potato. So you're seeing that these bright orange foods, whether it's orange juice or whether it's acorn squash or sweet potato or carrots, that we're going to find these high amounts of potassium. Actually, we're going to find it both in sweet potato and in white potato. Just a plain old baked potato with skin is going to have 850 milligrams of potassium. A lot of the potassium is just underneath the skin. So if you're not eating the skin, at least eat as close to the skin as you possibly can to get all that potassium. We're going to find potassium in virtually every one of the fishes that we eat, but especially high in things like sardines. Last night I had an avocado sandwich as part of my dinner, and I didn't have a half of an avocado, but I split a half of an avocado with my hubby's sandwich, and there was 750 milligrams of potassium right there. So when we think about just this handful of nutrients, starting with potassium, we have to remember that 1 out of 3 adults in America has high blood pressure. And when you're over 65, it's 2 out of 3. Not only that, what I see in my practice is probably 1 out of 4 people that come into my practice have pre-hypertension. You know, years ago we used to say that you didn't have hypertension until your systolic or your upper number was above 140 and your diastolic or lower number was above 90. We know now that as soon as that upper number or the systolic number is up above 120, you're up in the pre-hypertension territory. The difficulty that happens with the 75 million Americans that have hypertension is more than half of them don't have it under control. I commonly see individuals that come into my practice that are on high blood pressure medication and their blood pressure is still high. Not only that, we probably have 15 million or more Americans that are out there that don't even know what their blood pressure is. Do you know that you can go to any firehouse in Sarasota County and have one of the attendants there, one of the firemen there, take your blood pressure? There's no charge for that. Find out what your numbers are, because this is doing staggering damage as far as the arteries. Think about the brass nozzle on a garden hose. When you take that brass nozzle and put it on a garden hose and you twist it down and you raise the pressure of the water coming out of there, you can just erode the soil with that. It's so powerful. If you open that brass nozzle all the way and you just let that water just dribble out of the end, it's going to be pretty hard to erode anything. Well, you got to remember that of the 50,000 miles of blood vessels that you have in your body, I know that that's kind of hard to comprehend sometimes, but 50,000 miles of blood vessels that you have in your body, there's not an inch of that blood vessel that's straight. They bend and twist just like the bed of a river or a creek. And so when that high pressure is coming through that blood vessel, it's slamming into the walls of that blood vessel, creating damage. It's like it's being bruised all the time. So when we realize that 3 out of 4 people who suffer a stroke or a heart attack or congestive heart failure have hypertension, then we know that these numbers are staggering. and we need to get hypertension under control. And one of the ways that we can help to get hypertension under control is by getting enough potassium, because it's clear that it will lower blood pressure. About 25 years ago, they did something called the Intersalt study. And what they did is they studied huge populations of individuals, and they did them ethnically and they did them regionally, and they found out that if somebody took a potassium supplement, they would lower systolic blood pressure by 3.5 points. And again, remember, systolic is the upper number. And you might say, well, 3.5 points doesn't sound like a lot. But because of the fact that it reduces it and it will get people out of that pre-hypertension zone, we clearly see that as a result of that study, and there were 43,000 men in that study, and they studied them for 8 years. If they had the highest amount of potassium, they were 40% less likely to suffer a stroke than the people who had the least amount. You know, potassium matters because it counters the damage caused by sodium. And if you're eating out in restaurants a lot, you're eating too much sodium. The higher the sodium in the diet, the more the potassium helps. It's a combination of potassium and sodium rather than just either one of them alone. We don't know exactly how potassium lowers blood pressure. Maybe it's because the larger blood vessels are more flexible. So the flexibility of the big arteries like the aorta or the carotid arteries in the neck is very important in maintaining a nice, low, youthful blood pressure. As we get older, the arteries are less elastic, partially because of salt, partially because of age. So potassium may also lower blood pressure by dilating the small blood vessels. You don't want the tiny vessels clenched, because any resistance to blood flow is going to increase blood pressure. 4 weeks on a low-sodium, potassium-rich diet can reverse the effect of age on blood pressure. 4 weeks, you can make a difference with this. You know, the DASH diet, D-A-S-H, the dietary approach to stop hypertension, is one of the diets that's very rich in potassium. And it's rich in potassium because it recommends 11 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, 2 servings of low-fat dairy foods, and low amounts of saturated fat and sugar and refined flour. And a lot of times I'll have people say to me, 11 servings? How in the world can you get 11 servings of fruits and vegetables in the course of the day? Well, I started out this morning already having about 5 servings of fresh fruit. You know, when we look at fruits and vegetables, a serving can be a piece of fruit, you know, a cut-up piece of fruit, which is what I had. I had papaya and pineapple and a couple of figs and some pear or peaches in there. Thanks, Tracy. All of those were together in a fruit salad that I had for breakfast. And then I had a little bit more than 1/2 cup of plain no-fat yogurt on top of it. So I've gotten most of one of the servings of low-fat dairy products in for the course of the day in that yogurt, and I got all the fruit that I need for the day. So of that 11 servings of fruits and vegetables, I'm already close to four servings. So the nature of getting enough fruits and vegetables in the diet is always a challenge, and we're going to make some other suggestions for it, but you know, when you realize that you can reduce the risk of stroke by 40%, that's pretty inviting. Potassium citrate can be done as a supplement. It actually lowers blood pressure more than potassium chloride, which is what's in the majority of salt supplement or salt substitute type foods. And high-dose potassium supplements can be hazardous. If you have kidney disease and you don't know it, you could end up with too much potassium in your blood. That's a rare thing, but it's possible. You know, getting potassium citrate from fruits and vegetables also prevents kidney stones. The health professionals' follow-up study, which is a huge study following 45,000 men, realized that even though that wasn't what they were looking for, it's called a secondary discovery in a study, the individuals, the men in this particular health professional follow-up study that got the most potassium, over 4,000 milligrams a day, had half the risk of kidney stones of those who got the least. If you eat more fruits and vegetables, your urine citrate goes up, and that reduces the risk of kidney stones. So it's probably the citrate or some other alkali. It's not necessarily the potassium itself, but the citrate forms a complex with calcium, so it keeps the calcium from sticking to oxalate. You've probably heard of oxalic acid kidney stones. They're the most common kinds of kidney stones. And preventing calcium oxalate crystals is the key. So when we look at the benefit that happens with potassium citrate, it not only gets our blood pressure low, it not only helps us prevent stroke, it not only keeps us from making kidney stones, but there's a bonus for bones because citrate reduces the urine calcium excretion as well and probably lowers the risk of osteoporosis. I wouldn't put potassium as the ultimate key to bone health, but it's certainly an important piece in terms of bone health. So when we look at putting potassium on tap as one of the critical nutrients in the diet, let's just start out by looking at those very high potassium foods. And when we do so, we want to try to include some of those high potassium foods in our diet every single solitary day. And so, like I said, last night for dinner, I had avocado in my sandwich. And this morning for breakfast, I had about 3 cups of fruit. So when you start to learn a little bit about what has high potassium in it, and you try to include that more, anything from that half a cup of cooked spinach all the way through the clams and beet greens and yellowfin tuna and Pacific cod and plain yogurt and Swiss chard and acorn squash and sweet potatoes and lima beans and good old edamame, becoming one of the more popular snacks today, some salmon, tomato sauce or tomato juice, a banana. You know, bananas get so much credit as being a high potassium food, and granted they have potassium in them, but I wouldn't put them up in the top of the list as compared to something like a potato. A potato is actually going to give us more as long as we're eating close to the skin. That's the key. So hopefully you have a little bit more respect for potassium than you did 15 minutes ago. And you're going to look and see what's in your diet today that's going to raise that potassium level. Take that list and burn it into your brain, because what it comes down to is that we're just flat out not getting enough fruits and vegetables in the diet, period. That's another thing that happens when we look at the mineral of magnesium. When we realize that there are probably close to 25 million Americans now that have type 2 diabetes. Again, about a quarter of those don't even know that they have it. And another 60 million of them that have prediabetes. You know, diabetes is a nasty disease. And we're not talking about type 1 diabetes, which usually strikes in childhood. That occurs when the body's immune system destroys what are called the beta cells in the pancreas, the cells that make the insulin. And the body just doesn't make insulin anymore at all. And so those individuals have to be on injectable insulin. And they have to be on injectable insulin for the rest of their lives. Probably 5 to 10% of diabetic cases are diabetes type 1. You know, in 1930s, before insulin was developed, individuals who had type 1 diabetes rarely lived a handful of months after they were diagnosed. And yet today, individuals with type 1 diabetes can live a normal lifespan. Type 2 diabetes, which is what we commonly refer to today as diabetes, the body's cells just don't use insulin properly. The property of insulin is not able to affect the cell wall in such a way that the body can utilize it. And so the pancreas gradually loses its ability to make enough and the blood sugar levels climb. You know, extra pounds are the biggest risk factor. Lack of exercise, genes, diet, all plays a role. All of these sugar-sweetened beverages that we have, you know, too much processed meat. All of these things can contribute to diabetes. But, you know, diabetes is a pretty nasty disease when we realize that adults with diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely than others to have a stroke or die of heart disease. You know, it's the leading cause of new cases of blindness, and it's the leading cause of kidney failure. When we look at 60% of diabetics, they have damage to their nervous system. And, you know, one of the ugliest statistics that comes out of diabetes is 70,000 Americans have a foot or a leg amputated every year as a result of diabetes. So there's a real important reason to not get diabetes. I had a client in not very long ago, and she said, well, you know, what does it matter if you get diabetes? You just take a pill for it. Well, I would love to say that it was that easy. But in fact, we have a lot of evidence from observational studies that magnesium is one of the minerals that is important for the prevention of diabetes. So the next time you're going to have those edamame soybeans as a snack, mix them together with pumpkin seeds, and then that way you're going to get the crunch from the pumpkin seeds, and you're going to get all that potassium from the edamame plus some protein, and that combination is going to give you the mouthful of magnesium and the mouthful of potassium that you really need. Brazil nuts, cashews, they're all pretty high in magnesium as well, and they're definitely one of the things that we want to put on the snack list. The Nurses' Health Study is such a remarkable study. It's given us so much information because there's more than 85,000 women in that study. And the 40-plus thousand men that are in the health professional study, they're really giving us this giant body of information. And those who consume the most magnesium had a 27% lower risk of diabetes than those who consume the least magnesium. So it didn't really take a huge amount of magnesium to make a huge difference in people's risk of diabetes. The association between low magnesium and increased risk of diabetes only shows up in overweight women. But it may be more beneficial to overweight women because they're more likely to be at high risk for diabetes. But women with higher magnesium intakes, no matter what their weight, had lower fasting insulin levels, which means a lower risk of diabetes. What's more, in the Nurses' Health Study and in the Women's Health Initiative Observational Study, those who consume more magnesium had lower rates of C-reactive protein and other signs of chronic low-level inflammation. CRP, or C-reactive protein, is a measurement of inflammation that's in the body. And there may be a link between chronic inflammation, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. Obesity itself can cause chronic inflammation. So the two major features of diabetes are insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction. Well, chronic inflammation may cause insulin resistance, especially in the peripheral tissues, and plus it may damage the beta cells in the pancreas that actually secrete insulin. We can't show direct cause and effect with magnesium and type 2, all we can show is an association. But that association gets stronger and stronger all the time. Even fiber, folic acid, potassium, and magnesium are all correlated together. But for magnesium, we also have a lot of evidence from animal studies. There's really no animal studies on fiber and potassium and folic acid reducing the risk of diabetes, but we sure find it on magnesium. So maybe you're not an okra eater or a black-eyed pea eater, but, you know, that old low-fat plain yogurt shows back up again, and virtually every nut you can name, from pistachios to sunflower seed kernels to walnuts, the hazelnuts, peanuts, Brazil nuts, and pumpkin seed that I mentioned first because they're the highest, those are easy things for people to get in their diet. I ask people to start using quinoa a bit more. You know, quinoa is such an easy grain to cook because it's a whole grain, but it cooks in 12 to 15 minutes, unlike brown rice, which takes an hour to cook. So brown rice and lentils are also high in magnesium, but not anywhere near as much as quinoa. For an equal amount of brown rice and quinoa, you got half as much more magnesium in the quinoa. But, you know, even if you're just doing nothing but eating all bran cereal, you're getting a mouthful of magnesium. So magnesium supplements are also a place to go. I think magnesium should be taken on a daily basis, personally. because magnesium comes into play every time you've got anything that's twitching. So if you've got a tick in your eye, if you've got an arrhythmia in the heart, if you've got muscles that spasm, all of those things are saying that we need to consume high levels of magnesium-rich foods. It's very safe to get extra magnesium in your diet. And oh, by the way, it's also in semi-sweet chocolate. Just thought I would mention that. Magnesium and potassium. Who knew that they were such workhorses? But let's add another one to that list of what we don't get enough of, and that's vitamin D. When I realized that one out of every two women that it's over the age of 50 will break a bone because of osteoporosis, and it's not just a hip, they break a wrist, they break a shoulder, they break a bone in their foot. You know, there were over 2 million fractures that happened in the United States last year, including almost 300,000 hip fractures. When we realize that loss of bone mass is not just a calcium story alone. You know, if you ask people how to strengthen their bones, they're always likely to mention calcium, but actually calcium intakes are close to the recommended levels. The United States is one of the four countries in the world that eats the most calcium, and yet we're one of the four countries in the world that has the highest fracture rate. People get calcium not only from their diet, but they get it from a supplement. But what people don't know is that calcium won't prevent fractures if you don't get enough vitamin D. It's what helps the body absorb calcium. And we keep thinking that just because we, you know, walk from our house to the car, we're getting enough sun that we get enough vitamin D. But after having done over 300 vitamin D tests in my clinic, I'm here to tell you that the number of people that I've seen with normal vitamin Ds, I don't have to take my shoes off to count them. It's the combination of calcium and vitamin D that is really effective. Calcium supplements alone do not lower the risk of fracture, and that was clearly demonstrated in a meta-analysis that was done a couple of years ago. But when you look at calcium plus vitamin D, the risk reduction is significant, so we should absolutely aim for the recommended levels of both. Calcium plus vitamin D can also protect young bones. They took 3,700 female U.S. Navy recruits, and they gave them calcium and vitamin D. And the ones that received 2,000 milligrams of calcium and 800 IUs of vitamin D were 20% less likely to get a stress fracture during their training. Now, I don't know what they do to these women during the Navy recruit training, but it sounds like it must be brutal if that amount of calcium and vitamin D is enough to reduce stress fractures. So how much vitamin D is enough? There's a lot of conversation going on about what is ideal. Michael Hollick, who is the big dog of vitamin D at Brown University in Boston, he's actually become Dr. Vitamin D, kind of the way that Linus Pauling became Dr. Vitamin C. And Michael Hollick believes that we should get our vitamin D above 60. And so when you look at your test, it's 2,5-OH vitamin D or 2,5-hydroxy vitamin D. You need to get yours tested because we know that when we get it lower than 30, you're looking at a fracture. And when the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey was done, 70% of men and women had numbers lower than 30. We don't know whether you need 600 extra or 2,000 extra. But we haven't found anybody that's hurt by 1,000 IUs. And I have some clients in my practice that I put on as much as 10,000 IUs a day until we get their numbers up. People that have very dark skin or people that already have osteoporosis will definitely need more than 1,000 IUs of vitamin D to get their level normalized. And people say, oh, well, I drink milk. But a cup of milk only has 100 IUs of vitamin D. You know, you want to get 2,000? I don't think you're going to be drinking 20 cups of milk a day. Even a tablespoon of fortified margarine only has 60 IUs. Unless you eat fish like red salmon, where there's going to be 800 IUs in a 3-ounce serving, and you did it every single solitary day, you're just not going to reach those levels. We want to also understand that vitamin D lowers the risk of colon cancer. It lowers the risk of heart attacks and strokes, of type 2 diabetes. Even the beautiful study that showed that vitamin D reduced the risk of falls in people that were in assisted living and in nursing homes. It reduces the risk of autoimmune diseases. I mean, vitamin D is the rock star of vitamins right now. There's essentially a lower risk of dying, period, when you're talking about vitamin D. When we look at the huge intervention trial that's going on currently, that the United States government is doing by giving people 2,000 IUs of vitamin D a day or a placebo. It's called the VITAL trial. Actually, if you're interested in being part of the VITAL study, I'll give you a phone number, because you can go to vitalstudy.org, and you're eligible to join the trial if you're a woman over 65 or a man over 60. They're testing both fish oil and vitamin D, and you'll get your supplements for nothing and you'll get your blood work for nothing. You call 1-800-388-3963, that's 1-800-388-3963, or go online to vitalstudy.org, and you can get involved in this intervention trial that's going on currently. They're looking at cancer and heart disease and stroke and diabetes and high blood pressure and vision and bone density and memory loss, depression, autoimmune outcomes. All of those things are going on at Harvard Medical School, where Joanne Manson is directing this particular trial. But we also want to remember that too much calcium without vitamin D can pose a risk. When we see individuals that are taking too much calcium and they're not taking the vitamin D with it, we actually raise the risk of heart attacks. So I would not recommend going a whole lot above that 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams of calcium unless there's vitamin D along with it, simply because it can raise the risk of heart disease. Yeah, so there are lines that you can draw in the sand that say, you know, too much is as big a problem as too little, but what we're seeing in terms of the American public is too little is what is the most common. And the last one of those two little nutrients that I want to draw attention to is low vitamin B12 status. B12 is found in animal foods. And so we find B12 deficiencies in all vegans and most vegetarians. I have never seen a blood test on a vegan yet that was not B12 deficient. So whether it's dairy or eggs or fish or poultry or meat, if we don't get animal foods, we don't get B12, and we've got to do it supplementally. Plus, B12 gets harder and harder to absorb as we age. Some people lose the ability to extract the B12 out of the food protein that they eat. You know, the lining of the stomach starts to wither in some people and doesn't secrete enough gastric acid. And then people get heartburn when they don't have enough acid. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but too much acid and too little acid give the same symptoms. So then a lot of docs put somebody on an acid suppressor. Well, if you're on an acid suppressor, any kind of pill that keeps you from making too much stomach acid, then you automatically need to be on a B12 supplement, because if you're not secreting enough gastric acid, you can't get the B12 out of your food. So that's why the Institute of Medicine recommends that anybody over age 50 get at least 2.5 micrograms of B12 a day from a fortified food or from a food supplement. Even if you don't have the stomach acid, you can still absorb the crystalline form of B12 that's going to show up in these supplements. When you do a blood test on B12, it's one of the few things that I actually want the number to be higher than the range. So if we have 1 out of 5 Americans that have a low B12 status, and they don't feel like anything's wrong with them, but they're likely to do more poorly on memory and mental ability tests. Cognitive impairment is twice as common in people with a low B12 status. So if you feel like you're losing it, the very first thing you want to do is get that 2.5 micrograms of B12 into you every single day. In England, they did a big study at Oxford. It was called the Healthy Aging Project. And individuals who entered that study with a low B12 from the beginning were more likely to show a drop in cognitive function over the next decade. So low B12 definitely contributes to cognitive impairment in the elderly. And, you know, they always use the word suggests in these studies because they can't prove cause and effect. They can only say there's an association that people that had the lowest B12 had the most cognitive impairment. Now, remember, B12 isn't going to slow memory loss in people who already have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, but it can improve test scores in individuals that just, well, they don't remember really well. When we look at B12, it may be in your multivitamin. It may be in your breakfast cereal. But we want to look at B12 status in relationship to folic acid, because folic acid is strongly associated with cognitive impairment. The folate that occurs naturally in food isn't a problem. The normally circulating form of folate, which is called methylfolate, is not related to cognitive impairment at all. It's the unmetabolized folic acid that was a problem. I have methylfolate in my clinic, and one of my clients said that she'd gone to one of the, you know, big box stores, and she'd bought a folate that was a lot cheaper, and I had to explain to her that, well, they're not exactly the same thing. So unmetabolized folic acid comes from vitamin supplements. It can come from grain foods like breads and cereals and pasta and rice and tortillas that are made with enriched flour. And so companies are required to add B vitamins and iron and such to refined flour and to refined white rice. We know that there's benefits that folic acid actually reduce a horrible birth defect called spina bifida and other neural tube birth defects, but no one expected that this fortification would lead to this unmetabolized folic acid. So when the FDA decided to fortify the food supply with folic acid, the scientists just assumed that the folic acid would be converted to a natural folate on the way through the digestive tract. But they're finding this unmetabolized folic acid in body tissues. And they found it in about a third of seniors. So the unmetabolized folic acid, these people are more likely to take it in fortified foods and to take it in supplements. And we don't know why they're not metabolizing it, but it apparently is connected to cognitive decline. So look at the irony here. If you get too little B12 or too much folic acid, both of those things are worrisome. Something is going on in the brain with unmetabolized folic acid, and we don't know what it is. It makes it a little tricky to get more B12, because I can't tell you to take a multivitamin or a fortified breakfast cereal because it gives you a lot of folic acid. But if you're taking a multi, you get a full day's supply. That's about 400 micrograms. When you look at the difference in qualities of vitamins. I'm constantly beset with these questions in my practice. And people say, well, there's no difference between the cheap vitamins and the expensive vitamins. They're just naive. They just don't understand the difference in processing. There are some things that it doesn't make one blinking bit of difference what you get. And B12 would probably be an example of that. But when you're talking about multis, where you have the opportunity, or calcium for that matter, where you have the opportunity to put in some really cheesy, cheap stuff in that supplement, then it makes a huge difference in terms of, you know, what's going on in your health. So you say to me, well, Eve, I don't want to take any supplements at all. I think that the jury's still out. We don't have enough information. Well, then let's do it with our diet. Do you eat a main dish salad for lunch? You know, do you take 4 cups, take a whole quart, and put in not just lettuce and tomatoes, but put in that red cabbage and throw in some broccoli tops and scrape in some carrots? You know, when you've got that huge big salad as your lunch on very many days, then you're already in a place where you're going to have a beautiful, beautiful amount of vegetables in for the day. Remember, 1 cup of raw or a half a cup of cooked is equivalent to a serving. Let's throw in 2 cups of stir-fried vegetables for dinner or steamed vegetables. You know, even on the sandwich I had last night, I had a half of a tomato, I had a quarter of an avocado, I had two big old pieces of lettuce, I had a slice of onion. So even in a sandwich, you can load a lot of vegetables. But add them to everything. You know, when my sweet husband makes that sautéed onion and spinach and egg breakfast a couple of days a week, we're already starting the day with at least a half a cup or more of cooked vegetables in that breakfast meal. You know, in terms of grains, we're trying to get at least four servings a day. I did it yesterday because I had toast at breakfast and I had a sandwich for dinner. That isn't real common for me, but I got my four slices of bread during the day, and actually I had a little handful of granola as my treat last night. You want to choose whole grains whenever it's possible. You know, when you look at those fluff and puff loaves of white bread, my mother's quote always hangs here because she said that the only good loaf of bread will hold a door open in a storm. So if you're eating that fluff and puff white bread, the stuff that you can ball up into a spit wad like I used to do in the second grade and flick it at Mrs. Barony, then you're not getting any fiber out of it, and you're also not getting much in the way of nutrition. You know, when we're looking at low-fat dairy products, a cup of milk or yogurt, well, I eat about 4 ounces of yogurt generally, sometimes six, and I put a little milk in my chai tea every day, so I manage to get that cup in. That ounce and a half of low-fat cheese I had on my sandwich last night. So, you know, I got my dairy products in yesterday. You know, the lower-fat cheeses really give you all the flavor and not all the fat. Legumes and nuts takes a little longer for people to get used to throwing beans on top of the salad. I'm so happy about garbanzo beans being on most salad bars today, because you can always throw a handful of garbanzo beans or kidney beans on top of your salad. Now that edamame has become a much more prevalent snack, it's another goodie for us to add. But when I look at nuts, when I look at the fact that just a quarter of a cup of nuts can make a difference in the total amount of magnesium you get. Remember my list: pumpkin seeds, Brazil nuts, almonds, cashews, peanuts, hazelnuts, walnuts, all the way down the list, sunflower seeds, pistachios. Every single one of those is going to give you good magnesium sources. And a quarter of a cup, that's easy to get in the diet. In fact, sometimes it's hard to stop at a quarter cup. So the way that you do it is take all of your favorite nuts, you know, buy a half a pound or a pound of each of them in the bulk bin, put them in a great big huge salad bowl and mix them up, and then take your quarter cup measuring cup and fill up those little baby zip top bags with your quarter of a cup. Leave it in your purse, put it in your briefcase, you know, leave it in your desk. And then when you get the munchies at 4 o'clock, instead of going for the candy bar, instead of going for, you know, a sweetened drink, you've got those nuts there for you to eat right away. You know, I'm only looking for one serving of meat in the course of the day. You know, my reason for trying to reduce the total amount of fish and poultry and meat that you eat during the day isn't just about health, it's also about the planet. You know, we've got to be able to realize that the planet cannot continue to provide meat 3 times a day. I'm not taking desserts and sweets out of the offering. You know, having a cookie at night, I'm not worried about that. What I'm concerned about is when you have, you know, a bowl of ice cream and the cookies on top of it. There's just too much desserts and sweets in a day. Oils and fats, well, we need oils and fats in the day. We need a tablespoon of oil and a tablespoon of, you know, mayonnaise or some other high-fat food like my avocado last night, because the body requires those things in order to make our cell walls. So it's a variation on the DASH diet. Again, the dietary approach to stop hypertension diet that gives people the best blood pressure, the best triglycerides, the best HDL in it, and provides almost 5,000 milligrams of potassium and 500 milligrams of magnesium and plenty of calcium and 30 grams of fiber and less than a spoonful of sodium a day. The fruits and vegetable amount may seem overwhelming, but the servings are small. You don't want to measure, just make sure that they fill half of your plate. And then you'll be in a situation where you know that you're getting plenty of potassium, plenty of magnesium. Hopefully your vitamin D you're going to get from a supplement. And then that B12, I think we're going to have to get that one from a supplement as well. Because there's just flat out a difficulty in people getting enough from their diet. So figure out where you're going to put a baked potato in your diet this week. Maybe just one a week. You don't have to be eating baked potatoes every day. Because tomorrow you're going to have your cantaloupe or your avocado. A glass of tomato juice. A piece of salmon. A glass of orange juice. I read yesterday in New York Times that Edward Koch, the former mayor of New York, drinks 3 gallons of orange juice a week. And I'm going, well, that's more than a quart a day. The guy's 85 years old. It's going to be hard for me to argue with that particular strategy. When we look at the nature of eating real food, take a piece of paper out. Write down what you've had to eat over the course of the weekend. Put it into categories. Put it into categories like fruits and vegetables and put the amount. Try to be clear about whether you got a half a cup or a full cup or whether it's cooked or raw. Do the same thing with fruits and vegetables, grains, low-fat dairy products, legumes and nuts, poultry, fish and meat, desserts and sweets, and oiled and fats. You know, I always save a wild card because there's some days you just want a couple of cookies or you want an extra piece of bread or you're going to have 2 servings of meat in that day. Or it's going to be an extra high-fat diet. Those days are going to happen. But what we're looking for is balance over the entire week, over the month, and over the year, because the seasons change and the foods that are available in each of those seasons change. We're coming into apple and pear and grape season right now. The fruits of summer are gradually fading. Enjoy those melons while you can, because we start going into the tropical fruits. So there's plenty of variety for you to get a mouthful of magnesium and a mouthful of potassium every single day. And hopefully we'll understand that it's not always getting too much of something. Sometimes it's getting too little of something as well.